Tonight I'd like to speak about perception. And I've titled this talk, Can You Believe What You See? Do you believe what you see with your own eyes? Do you trust your perception? The Buddhist teachings invite us to be skeptical about the accuracy of our own perceptions and to refine our perception into the nature of phenomenon, the function, and to the nature of mind and matter. How does consciousness function? How does consciousness arise? How do we know our experience? Are we knowing our experience as it is, accurately? Or is it distorted? Is our perception distorted? Perception, perceiving as a process, is a conditioned process. And because it is conditioned by the past, it is vulnerable to error. It is always faulty. Usually we know things through our personal viewpoints, personal perspectives that are conditioned by our education, our family, our cultural backgrounds. They're influenced by our expectations, our desires, our hopes, and they're influenced by our past experiences, our personal histories. They're affected by emotions and fears, and they are karmically conditioned. The karmic conditioning of being a human being is different than the karmic conditioning of being a cat. As a human being, when we smell a rotting fish, we're not very excited by it. But when a cat smells fish, gets more excited, gets more interested. The way that we perceive is affected by the range of our seeing senses, our hearing senses, our smelling senses, our tasting, our physical contact, our physical sensitivity, our mental faculties. Our intelligence, our the quickness of our minds. And different people have different sensitivities. Some people can barely smell anything. And other people are very sensitive to smell. Some people have a very refined palate and can taste subtle differences in food. And some people can basically only tell if it's salty or if it's sweet. Or if it's hot. We've cultivated and we naturally have different abilities, sensitivities. And these vary within the human realm, and they certainly vary when we compare the nose of a human being to the nose of a dog. Dogs are much more developed with their noses than we are. But you might find as you meditate that you become more sensitive and that you can smell and taste things more distinctly, that you might step out and see more clearly, that the colors seem more vivid sometimes because of the clarity of our perception. But every human being and every animal, every being, has a different range of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and a different ability regarding thinking. We perceive the world through our senses, and so the way that we perceive our world is filtered and affected by our senses. One of the things that interests me about drawing and art is the demand that it places on perception. When we're drawing, there's some immediate feedback regarding how we perceive the object that we are drawing. And as we see the representation we're making on paper, we start to get some hints as to how it is we perceive. We might be making shapes but on the paper, but how do we perceive the shapes in three dimensions or in two dimensions? How do we perceive that something is near or something is far? How do we perceive that something is round or flat, solid or light, dense or porous, receding into the background or protruding up to the front? It's not just colors that we see in a visual field, but we perceive variations of depth, each dimension, differences in relationship, different qualities. When you visit a museum and see a painting, or walk down the street and see a window display in a drugstore, do you notice just the things that the objects, the vase or the flower that's painted, or the bottle that's displayed in a drugstore? Or do you notice the space around it? Do you notice the table that it's placed upon? Do you notice the frame that that defines the space of that display or that painting? Do you notice the background as well as the foreground, the shadows and the highlights? Do you notice what your own eye is attracted to? Are there certain colors that you find attractive? Are there certain compositions that you find pleasing? Do you find your eye is more attracted to words and text, or shapes and colors? Do you give more attention to human beings or inanimate objects? When you look at a painting, do you just look at what it represents? Oh, that's a beach scene, that's a landscape, that's a portrait. Or do you also look at the play of light, the shadows, the brush strokes, the juxtaposition of the different colors, the surface texture, or the surface that the painting is made on? Is it on paper? Is it on canvas? Is it on wood? You've probably all seen impressionist paintings. And when you're standing at a distance, you can look at a painting and say, yes, that's a beautiful impressionist painting of a beach scene, a picnic on a beach. And then you get closer and closer and closer and closer until you're just a few inches away from the canvas. And you find you can't see anything that could possibly resemble a beach or a picnic or people or a plate or food or anything. All you're seeing are dashes of pigment, of strokes of color, closely juxtaposed. In meditation practice, we observe our perceptions moment by moment. How closely are you looking at your own perceptions? What do you see? Are you seeing the concepts of them? Or do you sometimes look so closely that you see what they're composed of? That you see what they're made of? What forms the impression of something? You may notice that certain perceptions spark predictable thoughts, As soon as we perceive something, often we conceive. We create concepts about it. And those concepts quickly proliferate through a train of associations. I spoke the other day about papancha, the proliferation of thought. As soon as we have one experience, we have a thought about it, and then another, and then another, and then another, quickly associating until we're far removed from the original perception. There are important things to notice in the way that we relate to sensory impressions. And how does our relationship to sensory impressions lead, perhaps, to suffering? How do they cause trouble for us? We certainly are not trying to stop perception in meditation. Quite the contrary, we're clarifying perception. But we're looking at perception to see, is the way that we're experiencing life, the way that we're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, is our encounter with life distorted by ignorance? Is it reinforcing ignorance, craving, clinging, and suffering each time we encounter and react to something that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think? Or are we engaging in sensory experiences in a way that is clear and mindful, able to respond with kindness, with compassion, with wisdom? In the middle-length discourses, one of the great disciples, Mahakachana, said, "Dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. And what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye." And then the same statement, teaching, is given for the ear, for the nose, for the tongue, for the body, and for the mind. Basically, we receive a sensory impression, a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or a mental object, and it produces a certain feeling. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant. And if that experience of pleasure or pain is conditioned by ignorance, then it might trigger the underlying tendencies of aversion, hatred, desire, craving, or delusion, confusion. These forces distort our perception and produce a chain reaction of conceiving, of conceptual proliferations, of distorted thinking, of papancha. It's basically what we call a story that creates suffering and separates us from the vivid and clear experience of the present moment. And so we practice meditation. We learn to be mindful on contact. We learn to be mindful of feeling. If we miss the feeling, we might find, well, now we're lost in the story, might as well be mindful here. We basically bring mindfulness into that process any place along the line that we can. If we've already given rise to the story and created a rather solid sense of self, of identity, created meaning and significance to the story, embellished it into a big scenario, a drama of what is happening to me and who I am and what happened and what will happen and what I will become. we become mindful of that and trace it back to its original perception. Oh, there was a touch of this sensation, or a sound, or a taste. Very often, it's just a thought or a feeling. But we look to see how we conceive of things and what we perceive. What is your perspective on things? How are the basic processes of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking known? We should question the concepts we have about things. Question the validity of our perceptions. Question our perspective. Be willing to be entirely wrong in what we perceive. The Buddha said in one discourse, in the middle-length discourses, he said, in whatever way they conceive, the fact is always other than that. Why do we believe our thoughts when it might well be possible that the fact is always different than what we think it is? It can be very helpful to ask ourselves a few questions. When we think, when we're upset about something, when we're thinking about something, even when we perceive something, we can just ask ourselves, is that how it really is? Is it true? Can I know that it's true? How could I know that it's true? When we look closely at our perceptions, we question the accuracy of that representation of reality that has been constructed within our minds. According to the Buddhist teachings, perception is always distorted. You don't have to feel bad if you realize that what you perceived was wrong. It just means you're human. The distortion occurs not because we are evil, ignorant human beings, but simply because perception is a conditioned faculty. And it depends upon the conditioned, faulty sensory apparatus of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, etc. It is affected by our emotions, our desires, and it's limited by our previous experience and our memory. And so we distinguish between various aspects when we're perceiving a bare impact on the senses, when we're conceiving a story about it, when we're perceiving what something is. We try to see the movement between the impact of the sensory stimulus and the development of the idea about it, knowing full well that every stage along the way is conditioned and therefore faulty. Now, the Buddha talked about four distortions of perception, four distortions of thought, and four distortions of views. He said that to hold that in the impermanent there is permanence, this is a distortion of perception, thought, and views. To hold that in suffering there is happiness, this is a distortion of perception, thought, and views. To hold that in what is not self, there is self, this is a distortion of perception, thought, and views. And to hold that in the foul there is beauty, this is a distortion of perception, thoughts, and views. Well, I have a rather long poem. I think I'm not going to read it. That was a verse that the Buddha taught. I'll read it anyway. Those who perceive the changeful to be permanent, suffering as bliss, a self in the selfless, and who see in the foul the mark of beauty, such folk resort to distorted views, mentally deranged, subject to illusions, caught by Mara, not free from bonds. They are still far from the secure state. Such beings wander through the painful round and repeatedly go from birth to death. But when the Buddhas appear in the world, the makers of light in a mass of darkness, they reveal this teaching, the noble Dhamma, that leads to the end of suffering. When people with wisdom listened to them, at last they regain their sanity. They see the impermanent as impermanent, and they see the suffering just as suffering. They see the selfless as void of self, and in the foul they see the foul. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. I think I like this verse so much because he so clearly equates right view with sanity. And insanity as being the way that most of us, most people, most everything, we walk through our days assuming things will last. Isn't that crazy? And yet we do it. We wouldn't be attached to anything if we saw its impermanence. And then we wander around our day, about our days, trying to get things to be happy, whether those things be material things or experiences. Have you ever had anything that created lasting happiness? No, we're crazy. On a conceptual level, you might think, yeah, you know, I know that everything changes. I know that I can't grasp anything. I've looked and looked and looked and looked and looked in mind and body and this and that. And, you know, I have to admit it, but I can't find a self. You know, you could say, yeah, I get it. But if we really directly knew these and perceived with this right view, the perspective that sees things as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, then we would be continuously experiencing life from the perspective of not of right view, which would mean we would not be attached, we would not be clinging, and we would not be experiencing suffering. There might be pain that comes with body. There might be loss in life, of course. But we wouldn't be creating the mental suffering that agitates the mind. Usually there's some level of denial, of avoiding or ignoring these facts, some kind of preference to live in insanity, to live with our crazy views, because we want to avoid these basic facts of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the not-self characteristic of things. So I want to look a little bit more closely at these characteristics because they are the essence of insight meditation. They are the essence of what we have insight into. To hold that in the impermanent there is permanence, this is a distortion of perception, thoughts, and views. Okay. So we know things change. We've already established that. And yet we're often enchanted by rather superficial appearances. Many people are quite enchanted with beauty and with youth. And enchanted. And they forget the inevitable aging, decay, and death. We have so many reminders of impermanence around us, of death. But what does it take for us to get that, for for us to be stirred with a sense of urgency. The Buddha compared it to training a horse. Some horses, they just need to be coaxed, suggested. Go do this. And they do it. You know, they gallop or they work or they do whatever. Just the slightest suggestion. Others need the stick or the whip or whatever, that goad, you call it. And they just need a tap. And then they move. Others need to be whacked. And then others need to be struck really, really hard with the whip, so much so that it pierces the flesh. And he uses this image to ask, what does it take for each of us to be stirred to a sense of urgency? When we just hear about death, when we just learn about death, when we see a stranger die, when we see a relative die, or when we ourselves are dying, what does it take to stir us? What does it take for us to be willing to look beyond the concepts that are so convenient in life and penetrate to a truth that is profoundly deeper and perhaps uncomfortable, perhaps unfamiliar? The Buddha reminds us in discourse after discourse after discourse that everything is impermanent. Senses, perceptions, they're all impermanent. What's made of form and the formless are both impermanent. He uses many, many different comparisons. He describes kings who own the entire kingdom and control the entire kingdom, still age and die. He describes the sun and the moon as being impermanent. He talks about the heavens changing, the world coming to an end, and all the great states that we develop in meditation. Sorry. They also change. Even if the highest things change, he says, then what of us? What of this body and this mind? Isn't it a sort of craziness, a sort of insanity, to think that anything will last? The second item was to hold that in suffering, or this is dukkha, suffering could be, maybe a better translation would be the unsatisfactoriness. To hold that in what is unsatisfactory there is happiness. This is a distortion of perception, thought, and views. When we seek gratification in sensory pleasures, when we seek fulfillment, satisfaction through sensory pleasures, we're not seeing the dukkha, the unsatisfactory aspect to the experience. Again and again, we're sacrificing the ultimate truth just to seek a moment of sensory pleasure. The Buddha said the world is held in bondage by craving, and there is an addictive, obsessive quality to craving that keeps us bound in suffering. He compared this desire for sensory pleasures that can never bring fulfillment to gnawing to a dog who gnaws on a meatless bone. It simply doesn't have the capacity to satisfy. So imagine this dog who's thrown a bone that's already been cleaned of all its meat, and it's just merely smeared with blood. And the dog grabs a hold of this bone and chews it and chews it and chews it and chews it. But its hunger is never satisfied because it doesn't have the capacity to fulfill its need. It has only the superficial taste of meat. In a similar way, sensual pleasures are like the blood that's smeared on the bone. It has the superficial appearance of being satisfying, but it has no capacity to genuinely satisfy. Often we don't see the danger of gnawing on our sensual experiences, dwelling in them. And when we don't see the danger, we are excited by them, tantalized by them, entranced. We consider the experiences really lovely. Sometimes people come to meditation without very much experience. Everybody has their first retreat. Some of you are on your first retreat. And it's an exciting thing. But what do we do with this mind when we sit down and have just been looking at it for 6 days? It's never had so much attention in our whole lives. So we're looking at this mind, and at some point it gets a little bit boring, right? We've seen it before. Goes off into thought. We entertain ourselves a little bit. And then we start to conjure up fantasies to entertain ourselves more. And we conjure up pleasant fantasies of what we'll be doing whenever. Anything but here. How nice it will be when. How great I'll feel when. When we get engaged in pleasant fantasies, we don't see the suffering in it because we are enchanted by it. We are attracted to it. We are seduced by it. There are so many things that we're seduced by that we forget to notice the suffering aspect. We forget to notice the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness. Some people want a really big house, a kind of status symbol, space all around, plenty of space, lots of rooms, one room for meditation, one room for yoga. One room for the cat, one room for the dog. I don't know if you all have big houses. I don't know anybody who has a house with a room for the cat and dog, but in any case, imagine wanting a really big house. And then you think, oh, wow, now I have to clean it. Well, then you need somebody to help clean it, but then you have to schedule the cleaning. Then you have to, you have all these things. You have to furnish it. You have to this. You have to have that. The idea that a big house is better than a small house doesn't see the dukkha of air conditioning in a big house, or heating in a big house, or any of the things that come with whatever it is we think we want. Things always have, wherever there's desire, we're missing. When we want something, there's something that we're not seeing in it. And when we want something, we're usually not seeing the dukkha in it. Because if we see the dukkha in it, why would we want it? Now, one time when I was in graduate school, I spent 3 years in graduate school, and I lived in my van. I had one of those little minivans. It was great. Fastest house cleaning I ever did. I take it to one of those drive-through washing things. Very convenient. Very convenient. The Buddha saw that beings who want to be happy often do the very things that contradict happiness. They do the very things that create more suffering. when we really understand that sensual perceptions are always linked to suffering, they're always dukkha, even the most pleasant perceptions are still not graspable. They're still not reliable. They won't last. Then in the stillness with insight, awakening becomes possible. And what do we awaken to? Not some mystical experience, some transcendent state. That's not what we awaken to. We awaken to the fact of things. We awakened to the sensory perception as dukkha. I hope that doesn't disappoint you. The third aspect is to hold, the third misperception is to hold that in what is not self, there is a self. This is a distortion of perception, thought, and views. One of the great chief disciples of the Buddha, Venerable Sariputta, said, "To be reborn is suffering, not to be reborn is happiness." What does that mean? Often people fear the perception of not self and find that this perspective of not self is confusing, is incomprehensible. It might even trigger fear. It may be that we look into our experience and we have to admit that every aspect of our experience, no, we can't find a self in. But then, what does that leave us with? People often identify with their own bodies. And then there's trouble as soon as we get sick. If I'm my body, why doesn't it do what I want? Don't get sick. Stay healthy. If it was mine, it would be under my control, but it isn't. Sometimes when we get sick, our reaction to it is far out of proportion to the actual illness. It isn't just the discomfort of being sick, but our identity is threatened. We might have thoughts that circle around the illness, thinking, "Oh, I'm a weak person. I'm a worthless person. I am a failure because I'm sick." Because if we're identified with being healthy and capable, then who are we when we're sick and we're injured and we're vulnerable? We might get angry in that vulnerability and blame others or think, "I don't deserve this illness. Why did it happen to me?" When our self-image is threatened, when our concept of ourself is threatened, we have an opportunity to see and to ask, "Oh, what is this that is threatened? Isn't it the nature of the body to be sick? Isn't it a little bit of insanity to think that the body won't get sick, that I shouldn't be sick?" Illness is a wonderful time for meditation practice. Well, you can't do much else anyway. So you might as well pay attention. It's a little bit difficult sometimes for mindfulness with breathing if you can't breathe. But there's always mindfulness of the body. Sometimes when we're sick, we have a fever and the temperature changes, so we can do mindfulness of temperature. Oh, hot, hot. And then sweat happens. Chill, chill, cold, cold, hot, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. We can feel the weakness of the body. We can feel the changing fluid of the fluid nature of things. We can feel all sorts of different things. When the body gets a little bit out of whack, we notice things more than we noticed them when we're fit. But when we're sick, I think it's a great time not just to do mindfulness of the body, but it's really an important time to cultivate patience and to cultivate equanimity. Look into whatever the experience might be and see where there is suffering and where there is freedom. Ask ourselves, what is this really? And can I be open to this? Can I know this? We don't need to allow our minds to drift off into dullness and delusions. We can rest the mind in the fact of illness. Be present with it to whatever extent our energy allows. Gather our attention to be with the actual conditions of corporeal existence of this body as it is. You might notice your thoughts during meditation. They might not be very fancy thoughts. Sometimes by the middle of a retreat, you know, we've kind of entertained ourselves with all our usual stories, and we've repeated them, and we've gone through reruns, and we at some point have to admit that we'd never watch any movie that many times. And so enough already, and we turn it off. We say, okay, we'll just let it be quiet for a while. Might as well try that. And sometimes, though, there's still a little impulse to think. But we can't think of anything interesting to think of. So we just think, I am, I'm here, I will be, I was. And we can see the conceiving, the impulse to construct self, even when we've kind of run out of a lot of the content of our lives. And you don't really have to be on retreats to do this. I'm sure some of you have gone hiking or trekking or gone out into nature for some days. And after a while, you know, you go with a few friends and you talk about this and you talk about that and you gossip about this friend and you gossip about that and you plan this and you plan that. And, you know, after a while being out in nature, you kind of, all those things lose their interest. And you find yourself just sitting around the campfire or just walking on a hike with a couple of friends. In silence, content and peaceful, present, awake, listening to the birds, seeing the little lizards wander by, feeling the breeze, because the mind naturally has let go of a lot of its stories. We're doing a similar thing in the retreat, and as the retreat progresses, sometimes there's an upsurging of thought. But it's more like we're seeing them more clearly, as I spoke about this morning. But very often, we find that we're starting to get tired of our same old ones. And we try a little bit of quiet. We let them go a little bit more clearly. And then we just see this impulse of general self-construction, turning to this to create a sense of self. Wanting that. Why? I don't really want the thing. I just want to want. Because in the wanting, I am. And we realize I don't really want the thing. And so we let that go. And then when we let that go, we realize, well, maybe I can let the conceiving go too. Maybe I can let this impulse to compulsively recreate myself again and again and again throughout the day. Maybe I can let that go. And just sit and just walk. And when the lunch bell rings, just go eat. And see if I can see if I can experience or be just that without me doing all that. Until we let go of our thoughts, the thoughts that keep constructing a self-image, an elaborate concept of self, then we won't know the peace of just being
in the flow of experience. This initial delusion of conceit, of the self-construction, the I am, creates a self-position that distorts our experience. It's based upon any sensory experience, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. I keep saying that so that you know that mindfulness is not about watching the breath. It's about being mindful on contact. Contact with seeing. Contact with hearing. Contact with smelling. Contact with tasting. Contact with touching. Contact with feeling. Contact with emotions. Contact with thought. Contact with mental states. If we identify with any experience, then we can create the position of being the observer, the commentator, the narrator, the witness, the knower of it, the experiencer. And it's quite possible, unfortunately, to also identify with meditative experiences. So we're sitting and we're meditating. It's going really well. Peaceful, serene. I am such a good meditator. I think I need to tell the teachers about this meditation. This is really important. And so even the meditative experience of peace or of emptiness, we rush out to fill with self, to construct a self around it. When you see that movement happening, just laugh at it. It's not evil, it's not bad, but it's a little humorous. Laugh at it and settle back into the calmness, the tranquility, the peacefulness, the mindfulness. The fourth misperception is to hold that in the foul there is beauty. This is a distortion of perception, thoughts, and views. We've talked a lot about being mindful with what is, you know, what you experience, what you feel, what you include in awareness. But are you aware of what you exclude from your attention, what you don't want to notice, what you turn away from, or what you just don't recognize as being worthy of attention? Sometimes this might be things that we actively avoid or deny. But sometimes it's quite subtle. There are many practices to reveal what's called the repulsive element or the foul element. Culturally, most people like to see the idealized bodies that are young on magazine covers, beautiful bodies represented by models, but don't really want to see the old bodies, the wrinkled bodies, the hairy, smelly, sweaty bodies. But every part of our body ages. Every part of our body changes, and every part of our body smells. Even the most beautiful smile will be quite repulsive if you haven't brushed your teeth in 2 days. We can incorporate the perception of repulsiveness, of recognizing the not beautiful characteristic of things, right in our meditation.
I've did a lot of these repulsive meditations in the last couple of years because I've been training in a very traditional style of meditation. And so we do the 32 parts of the body and the series of decaying corpse meditations. And all of these practices can be used as a concentration object, and the repulsive element is also, the repulsive perception is also used as a vipassana, in the vipassana practices. I happen to like these practices, and so I did a lot of extra ones. I find them to be quite fun and an interesting angle on the dukkha characteristic. I do recommend that even though these practices, the classic ones, were somewhat designed from the perspective of monastics, I do think there's a lot that lay people can learn by taking on some of these practices and exploring them a little bit. The Pali term is asubha, which literally translates as not beautiful, not attractive, not enticing, not alluring. And we translate it as foul and repulsive, but those aren't very good English translations, and I don't know if this is a better Hebrew translation, but most of my English students, when I say repulsive and foul, they think it means, it is smelly, but they think that it means bad and awful, rather than just, well, there's ugly, there's a lot of words to it, but it's not a terrible thing. It's just like an aspect of it's unsatisfactory. And it's unsatisfactory because it's not beautiful. The perception that we apply to something is that it is beautiful. And when we see it as repulsive, it's not that we are, that we think it is a horrible perception and should be destroyed. It's not an aggressive thing. Sometimes in English, people think repulsive is aggressive. It's not aggressive. It's just being not enticed by it, but actively not enticed by it. So much so that we're really, instead of grabbing toward it with craving, we draw back because we see the danger of it. We see it as not beautiful. This asubha, a reflection, contemplation, is can be seen as one of the subcategories of the dukkha aspect. But in the vipassana practices, we can take it and highlight it as a separate characteristic. So instead of only contemplating things as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, we can contemplate them as impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, and not beautiful. So we can work with the vipassana in the four components. But actually, the not beautiful really is it is included in a thorough exploration of the unsatisfactory dukkha aspect. But every aspect of the body is impermanent. Every aspect of the body is unsatisfactory. Every aspect of the body is not self. And every aspect of the body is not beautiful, it's repulsive. But every aspect of the mind is equally repulsive. And even the beautiful states, the concentration, the calmness, the tranquility, the rapture, all the beautiful qualities that we cultivate, compassion, loving kindness, guess what? It's impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. And you know, it's also not beautiful. It's also not alluring, not tantalizing. It's repulsive. Because it changes. It doesn't have the capacity to satisfy us. We practice seeing the impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, and not beautiful characteristics of things so that we can see things as they
actually are. This analysis of things might seem a bit technical at first, or maybe confusing. But don't worry about the details. Sometimes it's helpful to just mull over these ideas and just to let them inspire a little bit of the way that we see things. We can train ourselves to observe anything and to notice, is it changing? Is it permanent or impermanent? Is it satisfactory or not satisfactory? Is there a self here or not? Is this really beautiful or not? If we have a tendency towards ill will, it's recommended that we train ourselves, in particular in loving kindness, in metta. If we have a tendency to lust, it's recommended that we train ourselves in seeing and perceiving the not beautiful characteristic of things. If we have a tendency towards doubts, it's recommended that we train ourselves in the reflections of the Buddha and the Dhamma, and to cultivate good Dhamma friends. If we know we have a tendency towards fear, we can use the protective meditations of loving kindness. If we know that we're basically lazy, we can emphasize a contemplation of death to stir some urgency. If we know that we're not in touch with our feelings, we can get in touch with our body, do body-oriented meditations, do more walking meditation practices, do work in a way with actions or sensory awareness practices. And if we know that we have a tendency towards distraction, then mindfulness with breathing is the recommended practice. Each of these practices has a certain place for each of us, and we'll emphasize different ones. The teachings encourage us, in whatever practice we're doing, to observe our perceptions the way that we would take a really close look at a painting. Take a good look at your mind. Take a good look at what you're perceiving. Take a really close look at what happens in a moment of sensory contact. How does something go from being a sound that hits the ear to being something that is known? And when it's known, what do we do with it? How do we interpret it? What is happening as we encounter the world? You don't need an art history degree to contemplate a painting, and you don't need a degree in Buddhist psychology to study the mind. Mindfulness and concentration are the trainings that bring tremendous clarity to our perception. When the mind is concentrated and mindfulness is refined and strong and our attention is stable, we will be able to explore contact, to explore feeling and perception clearly, carefully. We'll see how the mind functions. You won't have to believe anything that I say. You won't have to believe anything that the Buddha says. You certainly don't have to believe my quotations of the Buddha. You will be able to explore in your own perception with a concentrated, clear, mindful presence what happens in a moment of experience. Is it clear? Is it vivid? Or is it distorted by these misperceptions? Is it distorted by self-construction? In what way do we misperceive our experience? Not self is the primary misperception. And it's not just an interesting Buddhist concept. It's a pointer to look to see where suffering rests, where it forms. We learn how to untangle this distortion of conceiving and experience contact with the world completely free of distortional elaboration, distorted thinking. And then we will know what the Buddha taught Bahiya in the quote I used the first night of this retreat, when he said, "In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only what is sensed. And in the cognized, there is only what is cognized." Let's have a couple of quiet minutes, please. May all beings grow in clarity and love. May all beings be free.